thank you for being here. Let's see. So I'd like to start just by talking about your campaign in general. What made you want to run? What you see as the big story you're trying to tell, and the themes of your race.
Well, I don't want Portland to be passé, right? If we saw that article by Carrie Bai in the Willamette Week a couple months ago, I'm leaving Portland. Here's why. I don't want those kind of stories in the Willamette Week anymore. I just had a conversation with the mayor about, is Portland losing its soul? No, it's not inevitable. Let's do what Portland does and do things the Portland way, which is when we see something that we don't like, we come together and we figure out how to make what we do like. You know, so that's a big picture. We need then, in the mayor's seat, someone with a big vision for Portland that we haven't seen actually in a good long while, which means what for the person who's slogging through day-to-day life of congestion and housing affordability crises, you know, overcrowded classrooms, food deserts, whatever it is that you're up against in your daily life in Portland without being able to maintain necessarily that 30,000 view of what's happening for Portland, is we need a leadership, you know, someone in the mayor's seat in particular who can say, yeah, these are growing pains. This isn't a process that's completely predictable, an urbanization and a cosmopolitanization process. And there's another side. And it's like adolescence. Just because you grow from a teenager to an adult doesn't mean you're not you. It's just a process that you go through. And so what are we going to look like on the other side of these growing pains? I think you need a vision for that. You know, what's our next iteration of Portland going to be? You can't just be discouraged and bogged down in the problems that we currently face. Otherwise, you know, solving some of those problems is going to be nearly insurmountable without a North Star to guide us. Because I don't care what qualities of leadership you quote-unquote bring to the task, if you don't know the direction you're heading, how do you rally the people of Portland behind you and head in that direction the way we did 40 years ago when our enemy at the door was the automobile, and mm-hmm. we were convinced that what we needed to do was constrain sprawl. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things that get me pretty excited when I'm thinking about running for mayor. I watched the race for a while, and I didn't see a clear vision there of what's next Portland. And you may know from my day job at Portland State University, we've interacted with Bike Portland a little bit. I host leaders from around the world who come to study sustainability policy and best practices. And these are people who are experts either in developing policy for their own cities or implementing policy or coming up with technology or other solutions to make, you know, the urban transformation happen in their own cities. And they look and they say, well, you've done a really good job here, Portland. You've made a really nice place. But from the story that you're telling me, a lot of this got underway, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So what's next? And when they would ask me that question, I didn't have a clear answer, what's next for Portland? And I didn't see anyone on the horizon with that answer either. And I have some good ideas about what I think is next for Portland. So that's why I'm running for mayor.
What are those ideas? What if you describe a North Star? What are like mm-hmm. three or four characteristics of the Portland 30 years from now that we don't have today?
It's equitable. Number mm-hmm. one, we need to understand that climate change is the pressing issue of our generation, and that is foremost a human rights issue, right? Because whether or not humans are here, the planet is going to continue to go on. Mm-hmm. And if as a species we want to survive and thrive, we need to make sure that we're all in together. So being an inclusive city, an equitable city, a city where it's not about growth at all costs, but growth so that we can capture the benefits and continue to invest in our communities, our goals. So what does it look like 30 years? We're fossil free, right? We're a post-carbon city, and we're not struggling to keep up. We laid the foundation, you know, the 30 years in advance we needed so that we are leaders economically out front when it comes to clean tech, green tech, the kind of infrastructure, the kind of smart technologies we need to be a carbon-friendly city. Equitable. What does it mean to be a place where the prosperity is equitably distributed and we're not hollowing out our middle class and having income and prosperity concentrated in the top 1% while we're growing and growing poverty and misery for people who are already least able to deal day to day because of the lack of resources and lack of abundance in their daily life. And one of the things I'm talking about pretty actively is what do we do about racism here? You and I mentioned briefly Trump on the way in the door. It's on everyone's minds right now. the foment, the fervor among Americans right now is so almost without hope for some solution, and the racism and the biases are amplified in that atmosphere. And I think once upon a time, what Portland is, what it was aspired to be, an environmentally friendly place when other places weren't looking at that yet. They didn't understand that protecting the natural environment could be good for the economy, could be good for the people. We came up with that triumvirate of, you know, people and places and prosperity pretty early on and embraced it. But what does that mean now for us? If we're racist, right, we're not even able to begin to address how we're going to equitably distribute power and prosperity, because there are people here who have no voice and no role in how these decisions are made that affect their lives every day. And I would like to see us become an actively anti-racist place, so that in the same way we let Minneapolis get ahead of us in bike lanes, right, that, great, let everyone else get ahead of us in dismantling racism actively through public policy, the same way that we actively use public policy to reinforce and establish racism.
I'm not sure I understood the parallel to the between sustainability. We were ahead on sustainability. Now you're saying, are we behind on racism, or what are you saying?
I'm saying is that where once we were a green leader, mm-hmm. let's not necessarily have to be a leader in that, because we need all the cities to be doing that. I don't think the leadership part is what we should be focused on when it comes to sustainability anymore. Mm-hmm. Do we need to have more green buildings than other cities? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Let's have all the cities have green buildings. Let's continue to innovate and share ideas. I mean, it's a global network and a global conversation about how cities are going to be, quote unquote, sustainable.
Okay.
What I'm saying is Portland can get out in front again by understanding there's social work to be done now mm-hmm. on all of these fronts. And when we're a leader in that, we maintain our model status because now the rest of the world's going, wait a second, so first you guys figured out how to build environmentally friendly mm-hmm. places, and now you've got socially sustainable places as well. Now there's really something going on here.
Okay.
Right? Because that local resiliency, that local prosperity is what's going to protect us from an increasingly unstable global financial market, the same way as our climate resiliency is going to protect us from increasingly unstable climate change,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
So they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And that's something we need to be intentional about and talk about strategically, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the only thing to do. I've not heard a single candidate running for mayor talk about it in those terms, because it always...
Talk about what in which terms? I'm sorry.
The equity mm-hmm. in terms of the basis of our future prosperity, mm-hmm. right? So that's one reason why this is an important conversation for us to be having.
Right. Talk about the equity as the basis for our future prosperity.
And that's resiliency
why, that's
and
one
sustainability.
Of the reasons to do it.
Okay. It's at the core. You can't mm-hmm. have one without the other. And that's why I'm saying climate change and human rights are mm-hmm. inextricable at this point.
Right. Okay.
You have to look at them as one.
Great. How does transportation fit into that?
Oh, my goodness. You can tell me better than I can tell you, but it's so central to everything we're trying to accomplish, right? You know, as a transportation and alternate transportation advocate and cycling advocate, the role that getting us out of single occupancy vehicles just to begin with is going to play in not only our public health, our mental health, and our environmental health, but helping us meet our greenhouse gas emission goals, livability, safety, psychology. We need to be thinking about what is a car-free, or at least a post-internal combustion, single-occupancy automobile future look like. We realize it's not sustainable, it's not working, it kills people, right? When I think about Vision Zero and I think about the things we're trying to accomplish, I don't want people dying on Portland's streets. Like, as mayor, my number one task is going to be public safety, right? So, yes, we don't want people dying in our streets by any means. So the automobile and our relationship to the automobile is central.
Mm-hmm.
What are our alternatives? That's what becomes, right, the what's next question. Okay, Portland, you want to be a climate-forward city? You want to be a socially sustainable and a just society? Now what do you do about transportation? How we answer those questions is going to secure our future, I think.
Yeah.
And
so,
how we have those conversations, in fact.
So what are some specific steps we could take?
Well, we were laughing because we saw the trip on the way in, and I had heard you wanted to talk about Foster Road.
Yeah,
so out in my
right.
neighborhood, right? Let's go down to a real example. out on Foster Road where my neighbors and I think it's about 14 years we're into that Foster streetscape plan mm-hmm. now, and it got approval, what, 2012
right.
from City Council. There's been pushback, actually, right where, down the block where I walk my dog every morning and get my coffee, the European furniture store owner a few weeks ago hung up very bright fluorescent signs of, you know, call the mayor, this is horrible, the congestion's going to kill us, it's going to eat us alive, and then you saw this going viral
mm-hmm.
as businesses along the street, and then it comes up, well, so I called the neighborhood, I said, well, actually don't call, we Facebook message now, right, no one calls anyone, but what's going on out there? Why are they so upset? The public process, I mean, we've got the buy-in, all this is ready to rock and roll, what's happening? Oh, PDC's been out talking to so-and-so, blah, 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 this, you know, where, who's the liaison for this and misinformation? I'm thinking, ugh, this is exactly what we need to not be doing, and this is the way that we need to not be having these conversations. And a woman posted something on my Facebook wall the other day about, how can you talk about getting the automobile off here? Don't you realize about my commute times and the impact on business? And I thought, we need to be talking about the data, a lot of the data about what is going to be your increase in travel time for these furniture store owners. We have clear evidence that suggests having more pedestrian traffic, having more bicycle traffic on that street is going to be far, far better than having me and maybe six or seven other people walk past that store every day because I'm a pedestrian. But most of the people in my neighborhood are still very, very auto-centric, right? How's this going to grow that neighborhood? How's that going to positively impact our business environment? And I don't see a healthy conversation about that, even now when we should be so masterful at this. We've done so many projects like this around the city. How can we have this kind of breakdown right now? To me, that's unconscionable in some ways.
And the breakdown you're describing is what? What is the city failing to do that it could
well,
be?
Well, first of all, obviously this person doesn't feel like they were involved in the process, mm-hmm. right? Or they would have a clear understanding of the pros and cons from the get-go. So somewhere along the way, this person feels like perhaps they were left out of the process.
Sure. Isn't that the case with every process, though? Like, there are always going to be people who didn't hear about the meeting or didn't go to the meeting or whatever, right? He's got a business to run.
Well, and this is about the impacts of public, what does civic engagement in the 21st century look like? Does everyone have to show up at a meeting? What is that process going to look like? And how are we going to deal with that? I think the outreach about that needs to be about, here are the pros and cons, and here are the limits and the possibilities. So why, this person has an off-street loading access to, he's worried about freight, and he actually has many freight options that are not going to be largely affected by the transportation plan. The disconnect of this person isn't even understanding this means that we're not getting the information to her or him that they need to be able to make a rational decision around what's going to be best for their business. And if they do still have valid concerns, then how are we addressing that? You know, I hear the same things about the goat blocks and the density that's going in there when you've got some pretty freight-heavy, you know, purveyors
mm-hmm.
adjacent to that. And what is the balance of trucks and commerce relative to the pedestrian bicycle going to look like? We need to paint a clearer picture for the residents of Portland that these trade-offs, we shouldn't be creating us versus them scenarios. We should be creating win-win-wins
mm-hmm.
because our shared goals are the same. Right? We want Foster Road to prosper. We want those businesses to prosper. No one doesn't want that. So maybe one of the things we do, you put the freight information up at the top if we know that's going to be the biggest place of pushback, right? The same way as when they're trying to unclog Los Angeles' streets with the Move LA project. When it comes to traffic transportation investments, people worry about gentrification now. So you put the anti-displacement measures at the top. You make sure that you're valuing the things in your projects, not for the sake of the project,
mm-hmm.
that the project streets, you know, the Foster streetscape plan isn't about the project. It's about the people and the businesses in that place.
Mm-hmm.
And we miss that connection sometimes, especially the wonks who work downtown and who are worried about the right-of-ways and the signaling and the this and that, because we do want to maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of the system.
Right.
But we need to always bear in mind that these are projects that are foremost for communities, right? So that they must serve communities.
So then you're saying you come to the Foster Road Business Association and say, we're here to make this district more prosperous. That is our goal. We want the people here to be more prosperous. We want the people here to be able to live better. And they say, okay, great. What's your plan for doing that? And then you have to say, oh, okay, we're going to take this street to a turn lane and two through lanes and a bike lane on each side. And then they're like, what is the connection there?
Well, but what, obviously we didn't make the connection in advance that actually increased pedestrian activity is better for business than the more motorists. We did the exact same thing when we had the pushback on the transit mall from the downtown business, right? What? Still to this day, I don't understand why we have an automotive lane on that transit mall.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely ineffective, and in many ways it's unsafe because the cyclists have no way to go. They go, and skateboarders, they go four blocks out of their way to get anywhere, right? You and I both know that. You get get off the Hawthorne Bridge, and it's a tunnel to nowhere.
Right?
So, yeah, we have to stop in some ways and say, wait a minute, let's not make these decisions based on what's the way things have always been done, but what are our shared goals? That Foster Area Business Association, they have a great organization. They come to the table first. You don't go to them after the citizen activist or the transportation activist has come and already put their ideas on it. They already have buy-in,
mm-hmm.
right? This is about what are our shared goals as communities, and that's why when you put the equity question up front, the furniture store guy has a point. He's an Eastern European immigrant, probably largely disconnected from American political processes, probably largely disconnected from civic engagement here in Portland, maybe without that leisure time to attend a neighborhood association meeting once every month. How are we going to make that system work for him foremost,
mm-hmm.
right? So.
How indeed.
Yeah. And I think in some ways it's about meeting them where they're at, right? We, as someone who watched that process go for a very long time, I volunteered for that because I'm interested in transportation projects. But how do we bring the people to the table very early on? It's going to be the same question in East Portland, right? You can't have PBOT going into East Portland and saying to the people, okay, come on now. Here are some of my technicians and here are some of my experts and let's do this. You have to go there and listen first. You go and you find out, you gather the Foster Area businesses together. You say, hey, we've heard some rumblings that your street's unsafe. You know, I remember it was Sam. I was out protesting at 80th and Foster Road because people were getting killed, like mm-hmm. in the same pathway that my daughter walks back and forth to her friend's house. I mean,
this is in the Adams administration, you
yeah,
say?
During Sam, yeah. you know, with right. with Sam Adams. And we got the blinking lights installed there after that for about $70,000. You have to, like, be responsive to the needs of the people. It's not the projects first.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the community first. And if you understood Foster Road and the people who are operating out there, Buck from Buck Stove Palace and Nick Story, who had the Bob White Theater for a while, and people like me who own businesses out there, or even the Portland Mercado, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are your customers? What are their needs? What is your vision for Portland? What is your plan? And then the transportation becomes a tool. And while we're doing that, that's when the experts can come and lend the expertise and the understanding of what technologies can we put here. What is an incremental implementation looks like?
Right.
I've always thought that streetcar would be fantastic. I'm going to probably get pushback for this because not everyone loves streetcar, but as a development tool, I think streetcar and Foster Road to make good, strong connections with the Lentz Town Center, which has struggled and which is very connected to that green line. It would help increase capacity for existing transit investments and grow business.
Mm-hmm.
I've always said, well, I wouldn't mind if that...
That's what the space was there for in the first place,
that's what the space
right?
was there for in the first place.
Yeah.
So there are ways where you can think about things incrementally, too. Everything doesn't have to be a huge infrastructure undertaking overnight. Piloting things. Pick an intersection or two. Start small, right? Make sure that's playing out for the people of the neighborhood in the ways that they expect and anticipate. What's the feedback there? And I understand there are trade-offs with regard to efficiency, but I think there are ways, especially when you start thinking about some of the bigger arterials and our orphaned, you know, state highways and the ways that we're going to have to deal with them in the future. Incremental is going to be, I think, and pilot projects are probably going to be one of the approaches we have to more increasingly adopt
mm-hmm.
to get buy-in for some of the major transformative changes that we're going to have to make in the future.
What's an example of one of those major transformative changes that could use a pilot project to sort of communicate or research its effects?
Well, I think about 82nd Avenue a lot because
mm-hmm.
my neighborhood abuts it. But also it's so symbolic, right? It's the symbolic divider
mm-hmm.
between East Portland and the rest of Portland. And if there were a mayor right now, I would want to hear them saying a few things, right? Our post-carbon future, equity, sustainability, but also bridging the divide to one Portland and how we grow in East Portland and grow sustainably there without a lot of displacement is going to be, I think, key to our future, because how that works is going to be a model for the rest of the world and how you retrofit your suburbs in the post-auto future. Think about that, because that form is largely resembles a lot more of the rest of America than our beautiful 200-square-foot grid in the city center, right? That's a luxury that most places don't have. So, one, it's a way for us to be an innovator and a leader with how we do that. Two, it's about, okay, you've got some great resources on 82nd Avenue. You've got PCC at 82nd and Division. You've got a wonderful coalition in Epano and the Jade District and the Fubon Shopping Center there at 82nd and Division, where you've got a nice hotbed of activity. And you think a little bit closer to my area, where the folks at the Eastport Plaza have done great work over probably 20 years to make that. There are neighborhood businesses in that Eastport Plaza, even though it has a strip mall aesthetic, you know, and even though there's a Walmart there. It's not this us versus them, where you have these tiny bespoke boutiques versus the big box stores, but there's a real mix that actually reflects the Portland that exists in that neighborhood, right?
Right.
So what does it look like for PBOT to actually go there and say, we have some resources, and one of our goals as a city is to boulevard some of our major arterials to bring them down to a more human scale, to make them safer for pedestrians. Again, not creating this transportation option dichotomy, but saying foremost what we're thinking about is safe, walkable, vibrant, economically thriving communities, neighborhoods. So how do we pilot perhaps just a small stretch of 82nd between Division and Holgate, maybe, anchored, right? We've learned in our transportation projects that you use anchor institutions to help you drive things. So you've got PCC and the J District at one end, and you've got that Eastport Plaza at the other. You start doing a little bit of road diet, some gradual streetscape, maybe some bicycle lanes or separated bikeways, right? And not heavy, not huge projects, but slowly and incrementally helping folks realize their own vision for what might be there. Don't go in with a preconceived notion of what needs to be there. And then also knowing that we've got a lot of interest in Powell, right? And so then you start to think about how can this be a catalyst for what the goals we're trying to achieve with Powell, the bus rapid transit that we're thinking about out there that's hitting an awful lot of community pushback, especially with regard to the changes that they're seeing potentially happening in their communities. Gentrification, displacement, loss of frequent bus service, stations being located much further apart, so people with limited mobility having to walk further to get to their stops, right? All of these concerns from communities. And so then thinking about, okay, so how can we use the crossing at Powell there to, again, spread out so that we're starting to even just scale down a little bit from the automobile so that these aren't such shocking and traumatic transformations that we have to undertake.
I'm not sure I understand what you're proposing. That when you say scale down, or
simple things like the street level amenities, so the pedestrian safety, the bicycle safety, some of the low hanging fruit that you can get through bollards and street extensions and bioswales, and even if it barely affects the automobile traffic at that point. What psychologically, what you're starting to do is pull people out of these 6-lane environments into. You're pulling back space from the automobile and retrieving it from humans again.
So you're saying something like you could use bollards and paint to narrow change the angle of turning radius
just simple engineering, street engineering, street design. Mm-hmm. But the fact that what you're doing then is through them, you go based in the values of the people who are in those areas and say, what are your foremost goals? Is it safety? Mm-hmm. Well, then we'll make sure that what we're doing is increasing safety, right? Is it about efficiency? Well, then we want to make sure that fewer curb cuts would be safer and more efficient. Mm-hmm. So let's get people turning at the light, right? Just little things like that. We're based in the community goals as opposed to saying, our transportation goals are we need to get this many people out of cars this fast, and that's going to take y'all sacrificing. It's not about sacrificing, it's about winning, right? Especially in these places where you're having to bridge value sets. It's a lot harder. I mean, I make a huge sacrifice living at, say, 63rd and Foster, commuting an hour a day by bicycle or transit, as opposed to having an automobile.
Right.
Because actually, I could go much, much quicker in a car until I hit about 20th Street, maybe, is where the congestion actually starts.
Right.
30th?
Yeah.
Why would people, unless ideologically they embrace that, what's their trade-off?
Yeah.
Why get out of the automobile?
Yeah, just money.
Right?
Yeah.
So we need to make that affordable. We need to make it attractive. We need to give them a reason, and we need to give them options. And that's not us giving them what we think they want. It's about, what do you need here? When I hear the BRT conversation, the transportation wonk and the city planner in me goes, of course you want BRT. Don't you realize the development potential and the blah, 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 and the blah, blah, blah that you're going to experience from this? But the community member in me says, whoa, your concerns aren't real, and we can't focus on BRT at all costs. So maybe we even reverse the process of the bus rapid transit. What would happen if we actually said, we value you so much, we're going to start out at Mount Hood and come back to 82nd,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're going to show you, we're going to do it slowly, and we're going to do it your way, mm-hmm. in places where the cost may be a little lower for us.
Mm-hmm.
And again, incrementally, we did our first streetcar alignment. It was very short,
mm-hmm.
right? It was almost like a pilot project between Good Sam and Portland State.
Right,
there was
right.
a reason for that. It was strategic. It wasn't necessarily the most economically feasible strategy that we could have undertaken, but it was politically strategic that you had the buy-in mm-hmm. from Portland State University, and you had the buy-in from Good Samaritan Hospital there. So you had these anchor institutions that were committed to long-term survival, long-term getting people out of their cars. So even thinking about those types of things,
right.
what does it mean to get people between PCC and Mount Hood Community College, or the jobs and the resources in East Portland, and say, we value so much, you're going to get this first. You're not going to be last. You're going to be first, right? So
sure.
little things like that.
So you mentioned a bunch of changes to 82nd and Powell, all of which would have to happen over ODOT's dead body or with a bunch of money the city doesn't have to give to ODOT to take over, right? So you're not to give to ODOT, but to spend on the street that ODOT has not spent it on. So where do we get the money for that? What's your vision for getting more money for Portland transportation, if you have one?
Well, one, we do need to talk. We need to have some serious conversations with ODOT about those orphaned highways and how we're going to wrestle them back as streets in our city.
Mm-hmm.
I know, living on a street that has the scale of some of them, Foster Road, those are our city streets, not highways anymore, especially
mm-hmm.
as we grow. What's that conversation with ODOT got to look like? It's got to look the same way as the furniture store on Foster Road. What's in it for you? What can we do for you? And how are we going to pay for it? That's why I think when you do think about the systems development charges and some of the other things that we can do to spur development,
mm-hmm.
that's where our real estate finesse as a city, it can come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Because... And again, it's because piloting. We can do a lot more. We can do a lot in a little area, right, with local dollars
mm-hmm.
in ways that we couldn't do whole swaths. But then once we've got buy-in, I think you'll have a little bit more say, oh, you were able to improve safety outcomes here. Well, we have money for safety improvements. Or you were able to improve, you know, X or Y. Well, we have money in the budget for here. So it's about demonstrating.
Which budgets are these?
Well, with ODOT, so for money
okay.
that they're already spending on certain things,
mm-hmm.
we can then legitimize the fact that, oh, we will have these outcomes, it's just going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, I'm not sure what those negotiations are going to be like for how we get those dollars. Part of it is working with the state on how the VMT, you know, excise, is it excise fee? I'm not 100%
something like
sure
that.
What
yeah,
they
yeah.
call it. But,
or whatever replaces the gas tax.
Yeah, that needs to be going to urban areas. And I know it's a hard thing on the urban-rural divide, but the intensity of street use in urban areas, it's, you know, it's so high.
You're saying the revenue needs to go to urban areas?
We need to have an increase in the revenue in urban areas just because
mm-hmm.
the intensity of use on our city streets.
Right.
And I do not like perpetuating the urban-rural divide. It's actually something I think that, as you know, if I were going to be governor of Oregon, it was something I would have to work really, really hard on. And even, you know, if I were at the metro level working on the urban-suburban
mm-hmm.
divide, which is what we're bridging kind of between Portland Central and Portland
right.
East. We have
yeah.
to think about that, the distribution of resources. But also starting to think about how do we get users to pay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people talk about licensing bicycles and things like that. And I'm like, are you kidding? You know, other cities are paying people to cycle because cycling is so much less taxing on our infrastructure and so much less taxing on our environment. I can't even get behind that at all. But what does it mean to... you know, incentivize behavior we don't want, or incentivize behavior we want and disincentivize behavior that we don't. I think thinking about, again, the VMT as opposed to the gas tax, ultimately, tolling. We don't talk about tolling here. It's very unpopular. As someone who grew up on the East Coast, just like sales tax, it's hard to imagine life without tolling. I feel
mm-hmm.
like I'm kind of a free rider on the commons here a lot because we don't collect user fees. But we just had this huge project in Sellwood, right? A huge infrastructure project in this new Sellwood Bridge, and 70% of the trips across that begin and end in Clackamas County.
Right. So we have the power to put a meter, or like a license plate reader, and take a photo of every person who comes across and send them a bill.
The technology exists. It's not beyond our capacity.
But
it's
of course, that would be hugely controversial. It would set a precedent. Clackamas County would do the same thing to Multnomah people in retaliation or something, I suppose.
Well, they didn't pay in.
Well, yeah, sure.
That's the thing.
Don't get me wrong.
70% of the use is happening. They didn't pay in. So I think that when you're even looking at these deals, you have to have someone who has a regional understanding to say, hey, you know, City of Portland put in this, Multnomah County put in this, 70% of the trips are going to begin and end here. Well, you got to come to the table somehow.
Right? Sure.
We're going to have to think about that. And I'm not saying let's be punitive, but okay.
So what's the road from here to tolling? Where would that happen if that's a revenue source?
Let's ask everyone to guess. It's between Vancouver and Portland on I-5. Mm-hmm. Right? It's how we figure out what we're going to do across that river is going to be a game changer.
Yeah.
You know, maybe make the one great way would be to toll the automobiles and make really very affordable transit. So a huge incentive to get those cars coming in from Washington. We don't need them downtown Portland. We don't want them downtown Portland. They're not helpful downtown Portland. And I'm not anti-automobile. I don't want to be positioned as that. I want people to be able to use whatever option they need, but we don't need to necessarily be clogging up the streets with single occupancy vehicles and highways when we need to be moving freight and people have other, you know, commuters especially. Have other options in and out of the city center between them.
Sure. You support the gas tax. If the gas tax fails, what is your best alternative to it? What's the next step in the short run to keep the pavement from falling apart? If the gas tax succeeds, what is the next step after it expires after 4 years?
Well, I think we'll have to go for another 4 years. I have a feeling it's
going
to
be. Of the gas tax?
Yeah, I support. I mean, we're going to. I'm optimistic that it's going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
We're into such dire straits now that we just realize that the opportunity costs alone, if not maintaining what we have now, are just going to be horrendously more expensive in the future. So we need to do that now. I think the people of Portland get that in large part. And I don't think 4 years is going to be enough. I think 8 years. In that time, I'm hoping that something like vehicle miles travel tax will be more feasible technologically. I know there's been some libertarian concerns expressed with regard to privacy and whatnot that have been an impediment to that, but I think we can overcome that. Especially, I mean, I have no idea where the technology is going to be in 8 years, but I imagine that if we get this smart cities grant from the feds, which will be a nice innovation seed, probably we can probably start to look at some of that.
Yeah,
there.
That makes sense. I assume you'd be envisioning that at the state level, the VMT fee, and then you're saying that the long-term plan is switch to a VMT and get the state to give more money to the cities?
Ideally, that would be, because we'd have data, so we'd be able to know where the VMT was going, and
we could say, hey, look, the dollars accordingly. Sure,
that's one of the beautiful things about empirically driven decision-making, right? Or you can't say empirical in your paper. Can I change that to data-driven decision-making?
Sure, empirical is fine. What's wrong with empirical?
I'm too wonky sometimes.
Okay, got it, yeah.
I'm a transportation nerd.
No, we wonk it all up here.
Do you wonk
it
up?
No.
Get wonky? But, you know, things like that so that we're not making all these decisions so politically as us versus them and haves versus nots, but that we're in it together, you know, and we can get our share. And also, what does that mean in the urban areas where how we can support our rural communities, especially when you think about freight, manufacturing, agriculture? They may have things that they need there with trade-offs, say, for diesel and emissions, where they can accommodate a little bit more that we can't in the city. So we might even be able to work out some trade-offs there, too, as we're thinking about capping our carbon, things like that.
Right. One of the eternal questions of the transportation world is how much do you spend on making bad areas decent and how much do you spend on making good areas better? There's obviously, you talked about the pressure of listening to the communities. There's been a huge process in East Portland to get the East Portland Action Plan and Mobility Plan passed. We've had that conversation. We have a big list of stuff. We just haven't spent the money to do it. Same thing in the Central City. There's a ton of pressure to improve things for biking and transit to the places where people are doing it the most. You can't do both. You'd like to do both. How do you choose with $1, where does it go?
Yeah. Well, when I think about $1, I like to solve two problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
How, if we do make an investment in the city center, I think the question we should be asking ourselves is this. The return on investments in places where our markets are hot, as employment markets, real estate markets, we're always going to have a better return on that single dollar, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we opt to go to a place with a higher ROI, or return on investment, how are we capturing the value from that and making sure that it's invested in the place where the market bears to tread, right?
Okay. So you make a bunch of money off selling the post office site, and then you
I actually don't think we should sell the post office site. I think we should lease it. And I think we should actually capture the value of that land lease for whatever period of time that we determine. And that can actually go straight. I'm thinking of it in terms of urban agriculture in the post-tax increment financing era, which what does it look like to capture value in one part of the city that's thriving mm-hmm. and attracting investment? Capture that intentionally so that you have a you have outcomes in places. And
you can connect blocks in Gateway.
I think, Gateway, Lentz, mm-hmm. Again, around our education centers and job centers, important. And there's one thing, to talk about Gateway and Lentz just a little bit, because I do have some interesting ideas, having served on the PDC strategic plan and thinking about what the role of places like Gateway and Lentz would be like. One thing that's not particularly popular, it wasn't particularly popular around that table, but that I thought would be important is the fact that I don't know that every single place in Portland needs to be a compact, walkable neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I've talked about having them from edge to edge. I think there are certain places where if we're focusing on them as transit connected and job centers, innovation centers, employment centers, some of that's almost campus-like, if you will, but at a district scale. Some of that we can let the bar go a little lower just because as long as we solve our last mile problem through cycling or car sharing and things like that. Because there's some places when you think about, say, resiliency and if the big earthquake hits, all the firms located in an urban center mm-hmm. are not going to leave town.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to need some place to go. And probably that east side along 205 and out there where we've survived a little bit better is where they're going to end up, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to have some capacity for them in advance.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about U.S. Bank Corp, or are you talking about the Northwest Industrial District?
I'm thinking about all of the downtown.
Right.
What does it look like to have opportunities for us where we're not only thinking about... Let me back up a little bit. So what does it mean for us to build out places like Gateway and Lentz apart from the neighborhood aesthetic? What mm-hmm. does it mean to build them up as economic powerhouses in their own right so that... And I'm just using the earthquake as an example. But they're desirable places for business to go whether or not we had a natural disaster.
Right? Are they?
No, I'm saying they're not.
They're
now.
Not. Oh, okay, right.
But what would it mean to think about them in those terms? When you think about what needs to happen in Lentz, when you think about what needs to happen in Gateway, placemaking necessarily isn't what needs to come first. You need efficiency, right? You need efficiency of moving a workforce. You need efficiency of training a workforce. You need ladders of opportunity there so people are entering labor markets and having access to affordable housing in ways that are giving them chances to access wealth, right?
Okay.
And income mobility and social mobility.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the neighborhood there, not everyone needs to live in Gateway to be able to avail themselves of that in Gateway,
mm-hmm.
right? We're going to have intense investments, over $1 billion just in R&D alone at South Waterfront, which is very, very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Rents, very, very high rents, valuable real estate. What would it mean to be able to do some of the auxiliary services that tend to be outsourced, right, in places like Gateway?
What auxiliary services like what?
Billing, procurement, the things that move in and out from the airport. All. Okay. I mean, I'm not in the healthcare field, but
right,
I know
right.
there's a lot more than just the researcher in his lab and the nurse and the doctor who at OHSU.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of food processing that goes on. There's all types of services affiliated with the high-intensity
mm-hmm.
things that we're talking about at South Waterfront. Well,
right.
given the transportation infrastructure and the labor force out there and the capacity, accounting, payroll,
right.
I mean, all of these things that can be local, they don't have to be outsourced, right? What
sure.
does it mean to have a biotech affiliation industry, perhaps someplace like Gateway, where you've already got a hospital and you've got community college, right, out in those areas?
Mm-hmm.
Same way with Lentz. You've got a large immigrant workforce there. That could be doing value-added food products.
What's
right?
the city's role in making all this happen? It seems like, I mean, I can see that happening, but I don't know what the connection is to the
I think
the
when it comes
decisions.
To where do we make our investments, public investments, what if there's some sort of investment in a facility that needs to happen that doesn't pay for itself on the front end, but that we know is going to help us reach our equity goals in our workforce.
Facilities, right? Such as?
I'm thinking about a value, like a value-add process, a food processing center in some place like Lentz.
Okay.
Where
the PDC takes out a loan and builds a food processing?
Not necessarily take out a loan, but let's say there's going to be development going on there. How can we capture some? There's going to be a lot of development going on in Lentz in the next couple of years. I mean, a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And PDC has a lot of property out there.
Yeah.
What does it mean for PDC to make sure that some of that property is going toward our workforce office space and retail and other things so that we're not thinking about that necessarily that just has to be a compact, livable, walkable neighborhood, but that can be actually an economic engine mm-hmm. in the region. I guess what I'm talking about is changing the mindset a little bit from that having to be a compact.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Lentz probably aren't going to love that a lot, but being their neighbor, I kind of understand.
But you think you're saying that it's more important for it to be a job center than for it to be walkable?
I think there are places in it that can be walkable, but I think adjacent to the transit investments we've made already on the Green Line in Lentz, and then mm-hmm. also think about the Waddles Ball Field site over mm-hmm. in Lentz off the town center. Like that's a huge opportunity for a campus site
mm-hmm.
there. There's a lot of things that could be happening. My point being, I don't want to get bogged down in the details any of these projects because these are public processes that are...
I'm just trying to get some examples, you know.
More is what it would be is thinking creatively and outside the box about Portland's future and how that relates to transportation. Where do we have the existing transportation infrastructure? How can we intensify that around where it already is? And then what is the low-hanging fruit around that? I don't think every single thing needs to be necessarily the most glamorous project, too. Jersey barricades go a long way in keeping a cyclist safe from an automobile, right? Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of places, especially in East Portland, where a nice wide lane separated from that fast-moving traffic,
mm-hmm.
a Jersey barricade between a motorist or a truck and a bicycle would go a very, very long way for very, very few dollars and be a hugely symbolic action on the part of the city to say, we value your life. It's safe to bike between your home and your school or your home and your office.
Right. Yeah, well, that gets to back to the question about sort of central versus outskirts, and I do want to get a little bit more on that. You talked about sending PDC development dollars from the center to the outside. What about the decision about transportation dollars? I mean, Jersey barriers are cheap compared to some things, but they're very expensive compared to paint.
Yeah.
And, when you're making the decision of whether to increase the number of people biking in the central city versus increase the tolerance for even thinking about biking on 167th, how do you think about that?
Well, where are people dying?
Yeah.
That's what you ask yourself, right? Where are people dying? And then you say, how do we stop that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's where you start to look at those investments. Because there are other ways. If it's just the can of paint and political will, then put that where the people aren't dying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where the people are dying, you put the Jersey barricade.
Okay.
Because what we need to think about, if we're going to truly envision Vision Zero, it's about not having people dying on our street.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. And that equity there is that some people don't get to have safe life and other people have dangerous life. I know, again, when I send my daughter out across Foster Road, it doesn't matter if she's in that crosswalk, that those motorists don't necessarily see her. She has to see them. Mm-hmm. And she's on her phone and she's Snapchatting. And
sure.
It terrifies me. Right? So, foremost, that is key. Now, when it's symbolic and it's about respect and places that we're going to invest in and say we value you, that's where I think, again, you go with these smaller things where if a city, you know, we can build partnerships around the types of outcomes we'd like to see. We do a lot with stationary development, so how can we do some really clever things in East Portland with some of the, if we do get the bus rapid transit, what can those stations look like?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that probably out there we don't need a dedicated right-of-way.
Mm-hmm.
For the bus, but that closer to the city center we should. And my understanding is that in the plan right now, there's not plans for a dedicated right of way. And I wonder to myself, what is the point of BRT without a dedicated right of way, right?
So, I've wondered that as well. Yeah.
So one of my thoughts would be, well, if you start where you don't need the dedicated right of way, it buys us a little time, too, to get Portlanders to buy into BRT, because
mm-hmm.
we haven't had it before, even though other places have seen the value of that before us. And then when it comes to that gives us a little time to fight for that dedicated right-of-way, too, in the places where we're really going to need it. Because I don't like to waste opportunities, either, if sometimes it means waiting a little bit.
Right. One more PDC question, then we'll close that book. There's talk about how do you fund the PDC after the URAs expire, and one of the things that's talked about is our parking garages in Old Town and the Central East Side as future revenue opportunities. What's your take on whether there should be public support for those garages?
Well, as a city, we should not be subsidizing the automobile at all, as a matter of public policy.
Mm-hmm.
So if automobiles aren't paying for themselves, and automobile-centric activities aren't paying for themselves, we don't put public dollars in that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's things we can do with dynamic parking, tiered parking, and tiered feed structures. The technology is coming online.
There's more demand at 7 p.m., so we raise the price at 7 p.m.
Yeah, sure. The technology is coming. And if we don't, most places it's already there, and if not, it's coming. And we can capture a lot of that value. When it comes to the parking structure, you know, I don't want to drill down into the details of that particular project and agreement. That took a lot, you know, that convention center hotel took a lot longer than it should have because of some political realities, and I'm not sure what the role of that parking garage played in that trade-off.
Yeah,
but my administration would be about being intentionally not subsidizing the automobile as a matter of public policy. We need to do that as a transit-forward city anyway. We're seen as a platinum standard when it comes to transportation around the world. I understand this uniquely among my opponents, that the rest of the world is watching what we do right now and following our lead, whether we like it or not, right? Which means you're on your best behavior and you model behavior, if even sometimes it's a little bit challenging, which means actively, one, stating the intention that we're going to stop subsidizing the automobile because it doesn't meet any of our goals. It doesn't meet our equity goals, it doesn't meet our economic goals, and it doesn't meet our environmental goals. Here's what we are going to set out to do. Do we build parking structures as a city? Maybe sometimes. I think in some places where we're trying to meet our affordable housing goals, allowing developers to not have to provide parking, getting rid of those parking minimums, maybe we do need a district parking area, right? But that could be an economic generator. It doesn't have to have a net
cost. Is that not subsidizing automobiles to
because
that area?
We're not going to pay, we don't pay for it as a city, right? We'll make sure that we allow them.
I see.
And that districts can have them if they need or want them,
but
that they must either, that there should be some basic environmental standards, maybe there's active use at the ground floor again, you know, because people are not going to give up their cars. We have to understand that. People are not going to give up their cars. We're going to have to transition toward electric vehicles, which I'm very much in favor of. But even those, where do people put them?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying with our affordability goals, having district parking that's on the edges of places is not a bad idea. Look at the popularity of the Park and Ride at the Orange Line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was full in like a week, right? And Eastmoreland was already complaining because people were parking on the streets that had been empty before, right? Because everyone has like a 3-car garage in that neighborhood. But I think it actually looks quite lively there now.
Yeah.
As someone who doesn't live in Eastmoreland, I have the luxury of saying that. But, you know, that structures like that, I think, are great if they help us meet our transportation goals, right? But we didn't have enough money on that to do what we knew the demand would be. Well, how do we come up with those dollars in advance if we anticipate that? And those are our goals, to actually get people on that transit. It's just about being intentional, what you're fighting for.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about equity a bit. Housing affordability is a huge issue. There are lots of different aspects to it. The aspect that we tend to focus on specifically at Bike Portland is about proximity. The parts of Portland that have gone the farthest out of reach for most people are the ones that are the most bikeable, walkable, transit-friendly. And are there steps that we can take, or do you think we should be taking any steps to make it possible for more people who are not as rich to live in those areas?
Well, I think what you do is you make sure that housing and transportation costs are included in the same metric when you're looking at affordability, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something outer cities have known for a long time. You can't.
That's what every household knows already.
Yeah, every household experiences it, right? Like, I can live and pay, you know, 70% of my income to housing if I have zero transportation costs, right?
Right.
And plus the time, you have to add the time variable on top of that. Sure, if I walk 2 minutes to work and then I have 8 modes of transit, including car, share, Lyft, and Uber within a minute on my smartphone, of course my transportation costs are going to be minimal, right?
Mm-hmm.
What we need to be doing is making sure that that's combined into a single variable, or I don't know what you would call it, but when we're thinking about, you know, housing and transportation costs are part of the affordability equation together. It's also about making sure that when it comes to transportation, it's about connectivity foremost. I think what happens when the further you get out in our network, which is you know, hub and spoke. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really realized our goals for multi-centricity yet, because the green line, we went with the best available option in that ODOT right-of-way there, so it's not super connected.
It's along the highway. Right, on the highway.
Yeah.
Right.
So we haven't realized development potential there. There are a lot of foregone opportunities there, which meant that that hasn't created the kind of vibrancy around those stations that we need to make those bus routes, you know, viable for the frequency that we need. It's about intensifying the investments when we do the density and we do the projects around the existing transportation infrastructure too, so that we can keep flooding the outer neighborhoods with as frequent bus service as possible. Because for buses really are the capillaries in the system that are going to get people closer to their homes and to their jobs and their schools. So we really need to make sure that we're focusing density in the areas. And I know a lot of people are talking in the transit corridors and town centers. A lot of people are talking about, oh, we need to have density everywhere in town. And I think density all around the city is very important, but densifying in those town centers and corridors is going to be key, because then we can keep the transit efficient and affordable for people, because it's that frequency of service and the accessibility of bus service that's key.
So you're saying the route to affordability isn't necessarily to make it cheaper to live in the current dense walkable areas, it's to create more dense walkable transit-friendly areas by running transit lines in places where we can create nodes.
In the current dense areas, it's already affordable and accessible, because the reason that they're currently dense is because they have good transit.
Okay.
Right. So when you're thinking about what's next, Portland, and what does that look like on the other side of these, well, or what's going to get us through these growing pains? We need to increase supply, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the arguments are that we just, you know, open up the field and increase supply, like, across the board in Portland. And what I'm saying is, and what the Planning Bureau is looking at as well, I just worked for, you know, over a year on the mixed-use zones, that where we looked at the density and the zoning in the corridors and transit centers, or town centers and transit corridors, that we do want to intensify in those areas, and we're even thinking a little bit about, like, kind of, they're calling it the awesome zone, but what does it mean to have even a buffer around that?
Mm-hmm.
So extending that out into neighborhoods a little bit, where you're stepping down the density into the neighborhoods. It's not just that wind tunnel effect on, say, Mississippi or Division, but you're actually growing this way, which is going to be a bit of a transition for some of those neighborhoods. But thinking about what that does is help us meet our density goals while we're able to provide the transit, because you're still concentrating the people around the transit. The more diffuse we are, the harder it's going to be to have those concentrated.
Right.
I mean, we do need to have density all around, but concentrated density, I think, needs to be around too.
So concentrated density, how many stories does that mean at the peak, I would say?
Well, it depends on what area that you're in and what the guy. I mean, I think they're doing a lovely job with high density in the Lloyd District and the Lloyd TMA over there.
Sure.
I mean,
but that wouldn't fit in Montevilla very well, right?
Depends on what the future of Montevilla looks like. Ask someone what the Lloyd District looked like 20 years ago. It was sprawling one-story things. I mean, look at the Lloyd Center.
Right.
I think we need to be prepared whatever our future is. That, again, when you make those decisions, why did we think Hassalo on 8th was a good idea? It's an eco-district. It's got a low-carbon footprint. The design is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
It fits with our goals of livability, walkability. It helps us with, I think there's like something like 800 units over there that are going to be a pretty affordable range by market standards, that close to the city center, the Pearl District, and other amenities there. It's meeting an awful lot of our goals. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that may be the same reality for Montevilla, and some people out there might love that, right?
Yep.
But what that wasn't doing was degrading something that was already there. It's seen largely as an improvement, and you're maintaining parks and green spaces. The walkability is going to be gorgeous over there now in ways that the Lloyd District was kind of a dead zone and not particularly vibrant. So when I moved here, you know, almost 20 years ago, 39th Street, which it was called then, it's now Cesar Chavez, felt like the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I took a job as an apartment manager out there to save enough money to buy my first home, right? And so our friends were like, you're moving where? 39th and Gladstone, right? Mm-hmm. And now I think as I pass 39th and Gladstone on my bicycle and still have like 2 miles, right, 3 miles to go, I think, wow, how times have changed. But what does that mean for thinking about 92nd and Foster? Some beautiful density there would be great, mm-hmm, you know, especially if we can connect up so that that green line becomes a viable option and isn't just, you know, it takes a long time to get anywhere, yeah, even remotely close to the city center on the green line. So I don't mean to just the green line. I'm glad we
No. Just got ups and downs. The, let's see. So just to clarify on infill stuff, you talked about density everywhere. Are you talking about the sort of missing middle garden apartments stuff, or are you talking about more general just upzone?
I don't think we should upzone everywhere. No. I think you do the bigger projects in the corridors and the towns.
So you're saying keep R5 more or less the way it is.
Yeah.
And
my idea for the neighborhoods is a little different, and it's something folks haven't talked about a little bit. And do please tread carefully on the Lentz and Gateways discussions too, because those are just outside the box thinking. Those aren't necessarily plans, and this is me thinking outside the box again. But what would it mean for us? I went and spent the night at the Hazelnut Grove. I'm going to call it an intentional community.
Sure.
Some people are calling it a homeless encampment right now over in the Overlook neighborhood. And what surprised me the most about that was people finding their own pathways out of homelessness by building tiny houses,
mm-hmm,
was the aspiration. And what you would see was someone who was sleeping on a sidewalk outside Nordstrom one night, somehow being invited to join this community, either through affinity or recommendation, because it is an intentional community. It's not just a stopover for strangers. They're building a neighborhood. They start, yeah, maybe you do start with a tent there, but then you build a platform, right? Your neighbors help you make a level foundation and platform, and the next thing you do is you start building a structure,
mm-hmm,
and you're building the structure, you know, with plans, building plans, and you're doing, you're making building plans, and you're zero carbon footprint tiny homes for about,
mm-hmm,
$1,500 using reclaimed building materials. Things like that, we need to be making space for even in neighborhoods. So what does it look like to have multiple ADUs,
mm-hmm,
behind homes?
Okay.
What does it mean to take existing big structures and cut them into multiple dwellings and maybe even change the use at the ground level? If it's an older Victorian that's going to get torn down or sold for $800,000 and made completely unaffordable, can we cut that into smaller units and somehow maintain the affordability by keeping it more feasible?
Right.
For that property owner, that property buyer, things like that. So it's not just the cottage apartments, because I do think it's important to have that nice level of, you know, multifamily dwelling, but it's about creative solutions even in the city. And that would be almost a different designation where you're incentivizing certain performance standards with regard to either community or climate action, but lowering the barriers on the building code side and the zoning side, just from an experimentation perspective.
Great. Let me hit a few issues. I want to get lightning round.
Okay. Are we okay on time, ma'am? I saw you getting up and moving, so she's probably going to want me to get moving.
I'm just doing something else.
Okay.
Okay. I'll be quick.
Okay.
The gas tax calls for, I think it's about $3 million for neighborhood greenways, about $4 million for protected bike lanes in the 4 years. How do you feel like that is in terms of the scale of investment needed for major bike infrastructure citywide? I mean, more or less, is about right?
Relative to what, though? I mean,
That would be most of the budget for construction for local funding of neighborhood greenways and protected bike lanes in 4 years.
How much did you say?
It's something like $3 million for neighborhood greenways, something like $4 million for protected bike lanes.
So 7 total?
Something
for
like that.
4 years?
Yeah.
That's very too low.
Okay. Yeah. So would you aim for a larger gas tax in the next round?
I think we need to balance some maintenance versus some of those safety and other infrastructure investments. So I think it's about the trade-off between street maintenance and other things. I'd like to see that move closer to 50-50, and I'm guessing it's not 50-50 in that proposal.
It's not 50-50.
Yeah,
it's 40 or so.
Yeah.
Yeah. The recreation, is there anything that you see a way forward on off-road, like mountain biking, single track, that sort of thing?
Well, I think the enthusiasts know best. I have to say I'm a utility cyclist. After I commute all week on my bicycle, I don't tend to ride it as much for fun like some of the hardcore people here. I run around and walk for fun. But I know the environmental conservation and the mountain bikers have come head-to-head a lot, especially in Forest Park. I think there's probably ways of thinking that maybe they don't have to be in some of our more pristine environmental areas would probably be the trade-off, and maybe even that's some great places where you have more sprawling areas to think about. What would it mean to have wonderful biking trails and things like that in East Portland, especially since you could ride your bike there, do all the fun things, and then ride back home?
Where would you put it? Makes sense not to have people in the most pristine areas. Where you send people instead?
Well, I think you look at the underutilized spaces and those kind of hidden bonus spaces. Maybe even some things,
Any specific examples?
I don't really have any specific examples.
Okay, great. That's fine.
I haven't given it that much thought.
You think is your belief that you have about policy that is most that you're most afraid is wrong?
My belief that I think is most afraid of.
That you are most afraid of. What is a belief that you have that you fear is wrong? Or fear might be wrong.
Oh, at my core, that focusing on social sustainability will indeed make us prosper. I know that ethically, theoretically, sociologically, it's what we need to be doing. Can we truly impact the market? Can we truly shape our destiny by focusing on what we know is good? Can we do well by doing good? You know, the B Corps, the social sustainability, the equity, will it be enough? We have to go there. We have no choice. I think doing it wisely, but it's one of those things where you've never done it before. Being an early adopter is a little scary.
Yeah, great. So. What was your first bike?
Oh my goodness, my first bike was a 10-speed Schwinn with those super, super... Well, no, that was my first new bike. Mm-hmm. I grew up a little bit poor. So my first bike that I learned to ride bike on was a red banana seat with the big... mustache handlebars with like that and streamers. And from the early, I love riding my bike. Being a campaigner, I haven't had much time to ride bike. But riding bicycle to me, I'm one of those people who's a joy bike rider. Like I have pure joy, like sing and smile. And
yeah, great.
I'm a total typical Portlander on that.
Cool.
Cycling brings me joy. Look how happy I am just talking about my first bike. Like I remember you like climb the hill and then you get to go down it.
I'm sure there'll be lots of pedal loser rides looking forward to Mayoral Candace.
Well, Bud still does one.
Yeah, that's right.
He does. Yeah. Bud still does one. But, maybe I will. If I'm a mayoral candidate, maybe my favorite bike hills or something like that. I love that video that Vanessa Renwick did on the yodeling. Have you not seen it?
No, I haven't.
You guys here? You've not seen Yodel by Vanessa Renwick? Okay, so now that you've got it on tape, find it. So Vanessa Renwick's a local filmmaker. She did, it's a woman topless riding without hands down that hill from Mississippi at Mississippi and Fremont all the way down to the bottom, yodeling on her bicycle.
All right.
It's fantastic. Great. Don't quote me on that.
Okay, well, I'll see what we can do about the...
no one actually ever lets me talk about bicycling, which is like what I love the most.
So let's talk about that. You've said several times that you want to envision a car-free central city, but I don't have a clear idea of what you see as the steps we get to that.
Yeah, I know. So we're looking at what other, to be a leader, and what does it mean to be, this goes back to me talking about what does it mean for Portland to be a model in the 21st century and people to look at us as a transportation leader. When you look at Oslo's commitment to being car-free in the city center, and this notion of car-free cities, I think that we need to start symbolically with a small part of our city center being truly car-free. Mm-hmm. And you would probably build it around the places where the existing infrastructure is tightest, the transit mall. And it wouldn't be a huge swath. It would be, you think about the French Quarter in New Orleans, it's about 16 by 16 blocks, and it's almost a car-free zone just because of the pedestrian activity. Mm-hmm. Cars don't do well there. But... what would it look like for us to have a portion of the city that was just not an auto center, right? What would it mean to get and pilot that? And I don't think it's going to happen by 2019 by any stretch of the imagination, but by 10 years, we can work towards something like that, right? Get that well underway, get the business community buy-in on the front end, right, behind the idea. But what would the commercial benefits be? What would that look like? What would that transition make? How would that feed into tourism? How would that feed into our green marketing globally, right? I don't know how we can keep calling ourselves a green leader when we have, it's taking me 45 minutes to get from, you know, my bus stop at 4th and Madison to the foot of the Hawthorne Bridge, you know? And someone said, well, get on your skateboard.
Right.
Because you'll make it a lot faster that way. But what does it mean for us even to just unclog our downtown visually, symbolically, but also functionally? I think it would be very, very effective. And it would put us back on top again as one of those cities that's willing to try new things, even when it seems like business as usual. Breaking out of that pattern is going to be a little hard. We have huge investments in transit. There are some little spots around the city, I think, that we could even pilot some car-free zones and really start thinking carefully about what our car-free future looks like.
So. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Love how I had to sit down for that.
All right. My interview seat. Michael, thank you so much.